listening to the Daily Traditionalist on Radio Area at radioarea.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 21st of December 2017. It's the winter solstice. It's the shortest day today, and from now on in, the days are going to get longer, and hopefully I think we're going to have better luck. We've had a really bad year of it this year, I think. Things can't really get that much worse. But before we begin today, I did want to say something that really cheered my day up. A good friend of mine baked me a special Christmas cake, and I just wanted to say a big thank you to him for that and all the help that he's given me throughout the year. And I've got another good friend with me today. It would normally be Matt Heimbach that's hosting, but he's unable to be here. But we have got his usual co-host today. We do have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Matt, how are you doing today?
Well, you know, if we're thanking people, I need to thank you, because you've donated your time all this time to put up with all my crap. You know, editing everything all free of charge. So you're the one, you're the hero here.
Thanks, Matt. It's just my duty. You know, it's all our duty to do what we can for our people. Whatever it is that we are capable of doing, we should do it. And, you know, I just thank God that I am able to do what I do and fill that
role. I could be a difficult person. So, and you tolerate me more or less fine.
Well, you're not that difficult, Matt. I tell you, that has been far worse, far worse. Anyway, what we wanted to talk about today, or what you particularly wanted to talk about today, because Thursdays are really the day for Dr. Johnson to pick the subject matter. And today, you wanted to talk a little bit about military dictators. Is that right?
It's one of my favorite subjects of all time, yeah. Did you want me to start?
Yes.
All right, wonderful.
Fire away.
Well, it was my very first major topic in college. The first political book I ever read in my entire life was Stanley Payne's book on Francisco Franco. And it was very fair. It's one of the few fair biographies of him in existence. And I began to realize a few things. I couldn't articulate it very well at the time. But I realized that, you know, the democratic systems at the time had fallen to pieces, that military dictators were extremely popular. They all came from the lower classes. They were able to go over the heads of economic elites and party bosses, and they actually got stuff done. And because of their background, they're populists, of course, and in the anti-communist world, whether it be Asia or Latin America, they're national socialists. In one form or another, social nationalists in one way or another. And people forget about these guys. Now, as far as, and I've done the last two Orthodox nationalists on Asian military rulers, Park in Korea and Suharto in Indonesia, very similar to each other. They both saved their country from Marxism. They both were extremely successful. They both were opposed by the West and accused of every crime you could think of. And are both, to this day, very popular at home, even though they've both been dead for some time. And you have a slew of guys in Latin America and East Asia that don't get talked about very much. And what little is out there is just, you know, liberal slogans about how rotten they were. But this is never the case. So I'm sensing a pattern here. And this is something that, you know, national socialism is, you can find it everywhere. And these military leaders, if they're given enough time, you know, have a policy no different, you know, both in Indonesia and in Korea. I can't find many differences in policy between those two guys and Hitler after Weimar. Very similar situations. They rescued their countries on the verge of utter collapse and turned them around in a very short period of time. And in fact, there's only three people that I know of in world history that have turned a broken country around that quickly. And that's Putin in Russia, Hitler in Germany, and Park in South Korea, maybe Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan. So there's definitely, Putin's not a dictator, but he does have a lot of executive power and a lot of charismatic power. So I'm definitely sensing a pattern here.
Is there a difference between a dictator and a military dictator, or is that one and the same thing?
Well, let's be careful with the term. No, absolute power is impossible. I don't care who you are. Wherever you go, you have to be careful. You have elites right in the military itself that you have to be careful of. You have popular groups to be careful of. You have economic elites to be careful of. You have other countries to be careful of. So everyone has limits. So I'm talking about, you know, most dictators have in the past been connected to the military in some way or another, with very few exceptions. But especially in the third world, the military is extremely popular because this was the entity that threw the colonialists out. And it is, not coincidentally, the only entity strong enough and organized enough to fight economic elites. So this is extremely important.
Well, I was just thinking, because the monarchy has absolute power. Would you say that that a king was some kind of dictator, or are there more checks and balances on the monarchy than there are on these dictators that you're talking about?
Well, I think they're very similar. Most monarchs have been military men. It's what made them monarchs. You know, Roman emperors certainly were. The females, it wasn't the case. But even in Russia, they all had military training. They all went through basic training. They all had a military rank. There's very few exceptions to that, except for child rule. I mean, these were mostly military men with military background. When the Russian Empire redesigned their uniforms, Tsar Nicholas wore it with a full pack and marched 10 miles to make sure that this would be comfortable for the average soldier. He was able to identify with them. I think the big difference, though, is that military men usually come from the lower classes. Suharto, Chung Hee Park, these were all from poor farmers. And both of them were born under foreign rule. So the nationalism as well as the populism has a clear source of origin. That's not the case for monarchs in general. Although, again, in the Roman Empire, you know, east and west, you had military men rising up from humble positions. The military is often the way that poor guys can really make a mark and grow. And their military record usually isn't that bad either.
So with the monarchy, the origins of it are in the military origins are with the aristocracy, and with the military dictators, the origins are in the working class. So there's a slight difference there, but it's the same people because it's the same ethnicity. It's just they're rising up from a different class, or they've been put in a position to be able to do that. Now, you're also saying that they're National Socialist, and I take it you mean by that without capitalizing the words, meaning that they are nationalist in outlook and socialist in their programs. But had they did either of these ones that you've been studying and talking about, did they ever actually mention Adolf Hitler or Mein Kampf or the National Socialists at all?
Well, I mentioned Chung Hee Park was an admirer of his, as well as Napoleon and Bismarck. I don't know off the top of my head if Suharto did, but I refuse to believe that they didn't think a lot about him because of the similarities in their situation. Even Hitler was a military man, although not active duty when he took over. You know, broken society, torn apart, poverty stricken, yet with great potential. Clearly there's, you know, and then Marxists on their doorstep. So it can't be. These guys had to have been thinking of Hitler quite a bit. They had to have been.
Well, National Socialist policies are just what happens naturally, I think, when you have an ethno-state and you have a leader who is trying to do his best for his people. They're going to enact the same policies that the National Socialists did. Now, one thing I remember reading about is that after the Second World War, there was a National Socialist state in Syria and in Egypt. And the reason for this is because there were people from the Third Reich that went to Syria and Egypt, and they were protected by the regimes there, and they were advisors. Now, do you know anything about that at all?
Well, I think you're referring to the Social Nationalist Party, which was founded by Anton Sude in Syria, who was Greek Orthodox. I don't know about Third Reich members are running down there. Of course, they were all sympathetic to the Third Reich, certainly when Israel was founded in 1948. You know, Mein Kampf was translated into Arabic and given out in Egypt under Nasser. It was really a part of their normal reading. And I think Hitler was very popular in the Islamic world. It should be noted, I think, that Chung Hee Park was very concerned with race in South Korea, just like the North Koreans were. Indonesia is kind of mixed to begin with, because there's so many islands, you have different peoples. But outside of the racial element there, it was identical. In fact, I'm willing to capitalize the word. And I think the reason is, as you say, you really can't avoid it. Given their class background and given common sense and given what they need to fight, what other choice did they have? You know, I've often told my students when I'm lecturing about Hitler, I start off, and this got me into a lot of trouble. I said, okay, I want you to think of something. Pretend you're a man who's just received power. You've just been elected president of a country. This country has no military to speak of. This country has absolutely no money. This country is being torn apart by riots. This country has been cut in half by politicians, and it's been taken over by foreign powers. This country has a very hostile empire right on its border. Other parts of it have been taken over by your enemies. The currency is worthless. Industry has been dismantled or doesn't exist. No one trusts governing institutions. People are dying at a young age. That's your situation. You've been elected president. What do you do? Go. And that's usually the answer I get. Dead silence. What are they going to do? And of course, they can't say, you know, they're going to say what Hitler did. What other choice do you have? And when I put it that way, of course, everyone has to rethink everything they believe politically, because that's exactly what all of these guys, Hitler included, had to face. That's what they were all facing. That's why strength and power and nationalism were absolutely essential, or there wouldn't be these countries today. Well, and that's exactly what Hitler was facing. So when I put it like that, he asked that question, what are these people going to say? Now, usually they try to change the subject.
I was just going to say, it seems similar to when people reach rock bottom, when they really get to really experiencing bad times. It's then that they make serious changes in their life. And they say alcoholics have to get right to the bottom of the barrel before they actually change. And it seems that countries need to be really at the bottom of the barrel before they break free and somebody rises up to raise the country back up to the standards that it should be living at. And it's interesting that this is mainly been happening in Asia, and we don't really know that much about it. And from what I can see, these great achievements that these men have managed to achieve in Asia, you're talking people that are non-white. Imagine the achievements that white people would be able to do if we were to put some of these policies in action. So I think the benefit of knowing this is that we can point out, look at the great things they did, and think how much greater it would be if white people were to do this. If white people were to do the same.
Well, Adolf Hitler, in a speech in 1936, I had posted it on Facebook at one point, talking about Asia, said, you know, in many ways they have a much older civilization than we do. We do not claim superiority to them, and their nationalism is just as valid as ours. With Hitler, you know, the Japanese and some others were the Aryans of the East. And he meant it. These are high IQ people. These are very motivated people. And I think there's more similarity. You know, we're not talking about Central Africa here. And Hitler was extremely respectful towards East Asian society. There's just no excuse for people not knowing about Chung Hee Park because of all the talk on North Korea. No one wants to talk about how South Korea got as powerful as it got. Indonesia is the world's fourth largest country. You know, it has 200, you know, it's huge. And it extremely significant. Had Indonesia fallen to the Maoists, all of Southeast Asia would have fallen. You would have one big pan-Asian Cambodia if it wasn't for him. And of course, there was a civil war right afterwards. The left calls it a slaughter. That just means they lost. And elements in the armed forces as well were bad. So, you know, this is the similarities that these guys all faced, Franco included, are very, very similar. And that's not a coincidence. But it's also not a coincidence that I say that the U.S. and Great Britain have to also reach rock bottom before anything changes. The lifestyle of the average American has to bottom out and then maybe they'll rethink their priority. That you know, it's all the same. We're all connected that way.
That's the thing. We're still too well off, I think. We haven't had it hard. There's still food in the shops. We can still get heating. We've still got a semblance of law and order on the streets. We're not really hungry enough yet to fight back. But one thing that just strikes me about this, I mean, what I hear about Indonesia is that it's an Islamic country, and something like 99% of the inhabitants of Indonesia are Muslim. So was this an Islamic regime? Did the Islamic religion play much of a role in that, or has the Islamization taken place after the fall of this dictator, Matt?
Well, that's a good question, because of all the speeches and everything I've read by General Suharto, there's Islam is not mentioned very much. It was a secular government. During the war against the Communist Party was the third largest in the world in 1965. It had almost 4 million members. Trained by the Chinese. This was a war they had to fight, and the Islamic, the mosques and the clergy were his biggest allies. In fact, they were negotiating, you know, they had militant Muslims that were fighting alongside the army. But it's not an Islamic state, but clearly the society is. Yes, you're right. It's the world's biggest Islamic country, actually.
Did that increase after the fall of General Suharto? And what sort of regime have they got there now? What sort of government do they have there now?
Well, it's very typical. Once Suharto died, it was this multi-party democracy. The situation is similar to Burma. The currency crisis of 1997, Suharto died in 98, bottomed out all of these societies. And Indonesia was included in that. So they've been struggling to even reach Suharto era levels. And they've lost some industry because these guys were all protectionists. But of course, the WTO forced them to do otherwise. The military ruler is very, it's hard to deal with. I mean, companies can't do what they want, which is really the whole point. So once these guys go, corporate America sees its chance. And then installs a very weak multi-party system. And that's been the case. Very unremarkable rulers since him. And in Indonesia, his son is now running for president, basically saying we need to go back. And that's why this has been and when he announced his campaign, that's when the world's press discovered these documents from the American embassy saying that, you know, yes, we've proven Suharto slaughtered 500,000 communists for no reason. Of course, I read all of these. They say no such thing. So that's not an accident either. So obviously, Indonesia has oil. They're the world's 24th largest oil producer, which isn't huge, but it's still significant. So it's a very strategic place. And now you have Suharto's son, who the day he announces his candidacy, all of a sudden so this is now a live issue. It's possible to go back. And I think, and in Burma as well, there's a possibility of going back. And it wouldn't surprise me if it did.
And these documents are what you were talking about in the Orthodox Nationalist yesterday. This General Suharto and Park, the one from Korea, the military dictators, but did they have good economists with them? Did they have economists that were saying, look, we've got to get rid of usury, we've got to reform the banks, or was this all was this all centered around one man, I guess is what I'm saying, or did he have a good group behind him, and did they understand the problems we have with usury?
This is a great question, because they all imported, whether they had native born or imported guys who knew more about economics than they did. They're military men, you know, they're limited in some of this stuff. Pinochet did the same thing. I mentioned in the Korean lecture I did that Park founded a committee against unlawful profiteering, which essentially was a committee against usury. And he threw a few bankers in jail until they paid their ill-gotten gains from excessive interest rates. And he only had to do that to a few guys, because once you do it to a couple, the rest all automatically start paying up. Islamic banking is important in Indonesia. The U.S. banks have moved in since the currency crisis, which was George Soros had created it in 1997. But in both cases, let me put it like this. There's a big difference between a technocratic system where a military leader like that will bring in economists from different parts of the world with different specializations and interest groups. And that's how they envisioned it. Interest groups, of course, would just be corporations, the most powerful elements in society. So they made a very sharp distinction between a technocratic regime and a corporate regime, or a regime based on powerful interests and lobbyists. And so refusing lobbyists or not dealing with them, the alternative was bringing in experts. And it clearly worked in all these cases.
And what do you think of President Duterte then? Do you see him as a military dictator? And do you think he's going to also make these economical changes and get rid of usury? What's he doing alongside the banks or with the banks at the moment?
Well, up until his, and even his move to the gay fag stuff is very cryptic, and very odd and very out of character for him. I don't know. Was he in the military at all? I'm not even sure if he was. I don't even know if they have the draft in the Philippines. He talks more like a policeman than a military guy. But, he's elected and he believes in the multi-party system. So as far as that's concerned, but because he has such tremendous charisma, it's going to be very hard for big banks and others to just do what they want in the country. He's a loose cannon, according to them, and so because he's unpredictable, they're going to watch their behavior. But he's still living in a liberal democracy, though. In these other countries, liberal democracy was gone. There were plenty of voting and plebiscites and referenda. That's true. These guys were genuinely popular, but political parties existed mostly for advising. There were elections in Korea under the military, and of course, with that kind of an economic explosion, they had no chance. And the same thing goes for Indonesia. The only party that was banned was the Communist Party. So I think on the surface it's very similar, but at least officially, it's still a liberal democracy there. Duterte probably wants that to change. But and there's enough military problems there where declaring a state of emergency is not totally out of the question. And, of course, the drug problem largely being solved, proving that it can be done, he could go move on to other things. So there may be more similarities than I'm giving him credit for. But it's not a bad comparison to make.
Yeah, obviously he didn't rise up through the ranks in the military, but he seems to have devolved powers to himself, powers which the governments we have in the West that separated the judiciary, the law enforcement. And I was wondering whether he was using the military to round up these drug dealers. That's the sort of similarities that I was thinking of.
Oh, I understand. Yeah, well, the military is still dealing with the Islamic revolutionaries. They've been off the top of my head, I don't know if they have the draft. They might. So if that were the case, though, then he would have at least some 2 years of military experience. As I can tell, the drug issue has been the National Police Department and local police departments, not military units.
I was going to say, it's funny how ISIS popped up over there in the Philippines. As soon as America,
right. The minute he said something, all of a sudden they pop up there. I mean, could they be more obvious about this?
What's the state of things with ISIS in Indonesia then? With them being a massive majority Muslim country, you would think that they may have a problem with ISIS. Is there anything to do with them over there?
Well, not that I've ever heard. It was really odd because ISIS only functions in countries that are opposed to the U.S. There's no exceptions to that. Again, Duterte would be the perfect example. The minute he kicks the U.S. out, they show up. If Tommy Suharto wins the election, I guess suddenly they start using two names. The one name is people from Java only use one name. But I guess he took the name Tommy somehow. I don't know how. But if he gets elected and he does go back to the old way, I think a problem will suddenly arise.
Well, when are these elections taking place in Indonesia? Is it at the moment or some point in the future?
The campaign is going on. I haven't been following too closely. But the reason I rediscovered this old topic was because of the threats against Tommy. I don't even know if that's his real name. They have to separate him from his father, so they had to give him some marker. But when I was in college, I founded the University of Hartford chapter of the National Traditionalist Caucus, which was a group that I broke my teeth in the late 80s and early 90s. And my chap got me into a lot of trouble. My chapter there, I named after him. I had a big picture of him in my dorm room, which was quite the conversation starter with the ladies. But who the hell's that? And I have to explain the whole thing. So I've been an admirer of him for a long time. Of course, he was still in power back then. So the elections, typical, banker controls everything. But this guy is frightening the regime a little bit. And he sees how successful Duterte has been. You don't have a huge drug problem there like you had in the Philippines. But the regime is scared. And that's why these documents, so-called, were discovered the day he decided to run for office. So he's clearly a threat to them.
They're trying to slander him by blaming his father for things. So there's basically that there's a movement in Indonesia that's wanting to go back to the last time they had a nationalist regime. There's a movement in Korea that's wanting to go back to a nationalist regime. And we've got this movement in the West, rising identitarianism and people that are calling for nationalism. So is this ethnic nationalism over there, or is it more leaning towards civic nationalism, would you say?
Well, because these are countries that have been under colonial rulers, the Dutch for Indonesia, Japan for Korea, there's a strong ethnic and racial component to it all. In South Korea, it was very blatant. North Korea, too, for that matter. You're going to get that in the third world due to colonialism. The problem with Indonesia is that it's so large. Korea is compact. And the different large islands have different agendas. Islam could be a unifying factor, but you do have a bunch of different ethnic groups there, which I don't fully understand that dynamic. And the army serves as a melting pot for people from different parts of the, it's 19,000 islands. Java, by far the most populous. They're crammed in there. That's where Jakarta is, the capital. There is a strong ethnic component to it all. In Indonesia, that's harder to sell because of the diversity of the country, just how it is. But the army and Islam can serve as a unifying principle.
Yeah, I guess that Islam would step in there instead and hold everybody together, because it seems to do that. It doesn't seem to have any racial barriers. In fact, it encourages the breeding with slaves of other races, so that there's no ethnic barriers there. But in Korea, I know that they are fiercely ethno-nationalist and they're real supremacists and believe the Koreans to be the superior race, and the same with in Japan, and the same with China, and it's seen as a good thing, and you're supposed to believe that your race is the very best. It's the same as when you have football teams and you want to believe your football team is the very best. And yet somehow in the West, white people, we seem to think that it's wrong to think that our people are the best. I guess that must be because we actually are the best, Matt.
Well, we certainly are a threat to the Jews. We're high IQ. We're the only real threat they have. But Asia is definitely another one, a threat, outside of the U.S. Again, high IQ, highly motivated, highly racialist, and Hitler said so. And I think they are a threat for that very reason. And even China, Willis Carto always said China is a national socialist state. It's a Han racialist society, as is Taiwan. Those guys are doing what we say we want to do. They're doing it on a day-to-day basis.
Well, there's certainly the example. This is what I mean. We can point to these nationalist states over there, these non-white nationalist states, and the improvements that they've made and the way that they do things. And we can point to them to other whites and say, well, just look how much better things would be here if we were like that. Why is it that we're not like that? Matt, I wish we could go on some more, because it would be good to talk about the Jewish influence there, but we're coming to the end of the podcast. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. Matthew Heimbach should be back tomorrow. I'm not sure who he's got as a co-host. So until then, I say go out, have a great day, and hail victory.
You've been listening to The Daily Traditionalist on Radio Arian.